Just to let you know, today's episode features people talking about the existence of substances that might alter a person's mood or well-being while taken. If that's not something you want to listen to with children, parents, grandparents, colleagues, in a car, in a house, whatever, we thought we'd give you a little heads up. We wouldn't want to leave you hanging.
The Head Stuff Podcast Network. Welcome to Mother Folklore, a podcast about words, Irish words, and words from Ireland. Derek O'Shea is unfortunately away, but I am Padraig O'Quivonig, and I'm joined today by, I think is it fair to say an internet sensation? I know you're an author, but I think that undersells it a little bit. It's Seamus O'Reilly.
Hi, I mean, superstar. It's for other people to say, but also for me to say if they fail to. Yes. Writer, author, raconteur, terrific dancer.
Bon vivant.
Bon vivant as yeah, well. Yeah, Shanaki. All those lovely words which I just get straight in and put there. I do occasionally have to write things in my bio, and it's funny how difficult it is to do it without sounding like a complete arse.
Oh my God, I hate writing bios. You just sound like a twat no matter what you do. Because then if you put in too little, people are going like, well, you didn't put this in.
And if you make it too jokey, it's like, you know, other writers are like, oh, fuck off. We have to write a serious one. Why do you?
Yeah, bios, you inevitably end up looking like a twat. So you might as well just own it. Just go for it.
Or just go blank. Go as blank as possible and just call yourself the superstar that you always knew you were.
Yeah, just go totally out there. Or just go full on philosopher about it. Seamus O'Reilly is.
He just is.
Yeah. But Seamus O'Reilly is, and he's here today. And Seamus, you have a new book out, which we'll get to in just a second. I heard you on Drive Time. It was a really nice, or not Drive Time. Whoever was sitting in for Ryan Tuberty was on.
Yeah, Oliver Callan there last
Oliver,
week.
Yeah. That was a lovely interview. This is going to be a lot more fucking irreverent. just warn you off the bat, but you first came to the internet's attention a number of years ago. What's the best way of describing this? Because if we had to, like, I always think, right, in some stage in the future when all this internet fad is finished and there's no more social media and we get back to beating each other up with rocks and living in caves and stuff like that, it's going to be very difficult to explain Twitter to people. But it's going to be even more difficult to explain the concept of Rush Hour Crush to someone.
Yeah, and also, I mean, in the post-apocalyptic wasteland where you've got your engineer, you've got your mechanic, you've got your... you know, heart surgeon lining up at the gates to be accepted into the compound, you know, and I wheel up there and I say, oh, I do some real good funnies, but I'll write them down for you because I used to do this on a computer, and then you have to explain what a computer is. I got the first little taste of sort of internet memedom was when I was first moved over to London. I was very, very depressed in a job that I didn't enjoy. And so I just started writing silly letters to the Metro, which is just the free paper here, that would have, so it was read by 4 million people every single day. And occasionally, in fact, always, pretty much every single issue would have one page that was just dedicated to Rush Hour Crushes, which was, it's like a misconnection thing is what they call it in America. It's people you've seen on public transport usually, but it sort of broadened its remit a bit sometimes, who you fancied. And so it's like a desperate, horny howl into the void, trying to find that person you saw on the number 15 bus and say, I fancied you, do you want to go for a coffee?
It is essentially it's a place for people to admit that they belong in horny jail.
Yeah, absolutely. Honk, honk, straight into horny jail. And they were so funny. I would read them every single day because a lot of them were very speculative. Like, I mean, it's a pretty tall order anyway. I mean, if someone remembering they were on a bus at one specific time and remember it, they'd say things like, you were wearing the brown shirt and you had blonde hair and I'd love to go for a coffee with you. You're like, that's not even enough to go on. Yeah. And that's before you get to some of them that were deeply strange.
Some of them were downright disturbing. All those ones like we locked eye contact on the number 15 bus and stuff like that. It's like,
yeah, I mean, you can
maybe
you still
did, pal.
Yeah, you can still exactly. And I think we've all experienced, particularly men who do not read signals. So at least, I mean, maybe this is better than them. I mean, almost definitely is better than
That's
going up to the person.
Much better than that. Yeah.
But it's still, it's like catalogs them. I mean, you should probably, if you're using it sincerely, be placed on a register. But I was so taken with them, I thought, well, maybe I could write something in so ridiculous and see if it gets printed. And the first one I ever sent in got published. So it's that thing about, you know, gambling addicts always say, just you should never win your first bet. and I did. So I sent in something like 80 over the course of 3 or 4 years, and I got 26, 27, something like that published.
That's a decent strike rate. That's, oh, that's yeah. not bad. Like, yeah.
And like, there's not really much to choose between the ones that did and didn't in terms of ridiculousness. It could have just been they got loads more that day. Yeah. It was always from a different email, always from a different phone number or whatever. It was all, I had people like in the office I worked in, I was like, yeah, can I use your phone? Oh, you didn't have a crush. So I was completely, like, clearly you can look back, if I was on the psychiatrist's couch, I think, you know, it would be the easiest fiver they ever earned to tell me in 30 seconds that clearly I was someone in need of a creative outlet.
Yeah.
I was desperate to just get my name in ink. And even if my name itself wasn't actually there. So I was doing that just to entertain literally my friends, like people on my Facebook.
I cannot read any of them with a straight face. Like, I can't. Sometimes you think I'm doing well, I'm reading this one with a straight face. And then you get to the name, the sign off. And sometimes, like, all the humour's in the sign-off that you've given it.
Yeah, well, there's one that went out again today. I mean, it just, because some of them became memes of their own. So because they're not all, like, you know, the incredible raconteur Seamus O'Reilly writes, you know, most of the time they are, they're just sent out, they have their own life. So there's one that I did, which particularly comes back every single day. Just 4 hours ago, No Context Brits reposted it. And it's a perfect example of that. It just reads, to the sexy Spanish senorita on the number 30 bus to Highbury. I loved our heated chat on Friday, but realised what I did was insensitive to your country. I'm mortified. Please let me make up for it over tapas or paella or whatever. Signed, bearded man who used discarded burger cartons as castanets. So...
That was the one I was going to use as an example. I can't listen to it without laughing. I can't read it with a straight face. Like, and it's funny enough as it goes right through. Like, you get to the bit where it's, let me take you out for, like, I was culturally insensitive. Let me bring you out for fucking tapas or paella or whatever you eat. Yeah. Very funny. But then...
Yeah, well, I always wanted the sign off to be part of the joke at least.
Yeah.
The thing about that one is that one has had a second, third, fourth, fifth, and, you know, 20th life. So, like, that was, you know, that was shared again today for like the 100 millionth time. So it's
by
it's,
the No Context Brits, more yeah, cultural so, appropriation.
I know. I replied, you know, this is by me, some context Irishes. So that was an early shot across the bow for my boredom meeting my propensity for attention seeking. And then as other things went on, I think that horrible algebra only became more profitable.
Do you reckon someone in the metro cottoned on at any stage that there was one deviant out there, one miscreant sending in the most ridiculous ones? That said, maybe not, because some of the sincere ones are pretty fucking ridiculous to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I did have some contact with the people at Rush Hour Crush, because once or twice they would get back to me. I mean, I'd have email. I think I used about 14 different emails, and loads, because you can do it by email, you can do it by phone. I never used the same email twice or the same phone twice. I think they probably presume some of them are bluffers, and I think they are pretty sanguine about that. I don't think they mind having something that people can laugh at. But once or twice I got responses from, hey, we noticed that you sent in a thing. Would you like to talk to us about how you find that experience? Because I believe every 2 or 3 years they do, say, for example, I think when I was doing it, there was one couple who got married and they wrote to the Metro and said, we met through a Rush Hour Crush, you know, one of those stories. And so the Metro sent people to their wedding, and, you know, it was like a little, you know, like when Cilla Black used to go to the wedding on Blind Date, I think it happened a few times. You know, it's like you roll the dice 4 million times, you know, you're going to
come up
occasionally. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like when I was doing it, I didn't know anybody because this was probably 2013, 2014, I didn't really know anybody who'd used much of Tinder or, geez, it would have been like Plenty of Fish and stuff then.
So it was OkCupid and stuff like that.
Okay, so like 7 or 8 years ago, like you forget just how quickly that happened, where it went from being something that was like a joke on sitcoms, like, oh, internet dating, to being just literally the only way that anybody meets anyone. So back then, maybe it had more of a purpose and people were like, and obviously if people were getting married from it, it did, but yeah, they did
back,
get in
back
touch.
Back then people used to approach each other in public though.
Disgraceful.
I don't know. I just don't know how somebody looks like. The first one you ever sent in was to the guy who got on a bank dressed like Mr. Chips from Catchphrase. Your cheeky smile reminds me of popular sayings. And it's signed, girl in bring back hanging t-shirt. I don't know how somebody is sitting there, probably somebody in the metro who hates their job just as much as you did, going like, more of these perverts. I have to publish 2 letters from perverts today. Fuck it. Let's put this one in.
Yeah, whenever I used to put them up, because I'd put them up afterwards. So like, but I'd still be able to get them in all the time because I wasn't using my own name. But presumably they were working out that it was a certain style of ones. But then that's obviously not true, because as well as obviously reading it myself and seeing the weird ones, I constantly get weird ones sent to me saying, oh, is this you again?
Is that you?
And I'm like, no, it's not. I'm sorry.
That's a genuine pervert. That's a real pervert who wants to talk to some woman who never even looked at him on the bus. Oh my God. So you started this because you'd moved to London from Derry.
Well, I was in college.
Oh, you were in Dublin,
so,
for a while.
So in Derry, Dublin for 7 years, which is why my accent has flattened out slightly. And then went to from Dublin then to London 10 years ago.
Cool. And had you engaged in any writing beforehand? Is this something that you'd always had in mind that you'd like to give it a rattle? Or was it just you accidentally found yourself as the author, the incredible raconteur, the one, the only, when you were basically pretending to be a pervert in the metro?
I wrote all the way through school and also was involved in an early version of Pure Derry, that sort of like satire thing that was in Derry whenever I was like 16 or 17. But then when I went to Dublin, I was just having way too much fun. And also everybody I knew who was doing journalism on a professional level was, you know, A, not making very much money, and B, had an awful lot of horrible work that they had to do. So I didn't really have the option of not making money because I had no money. And I was in a different city. And also I discovered, you know, loads of other things to take my mind off things. So I was always working jobs, and I was always, if not that, I was studying, and I never had any money. So the idea of taking on a sort of a ludicrous, creative sort of jump into the void was quite tough, especially considering I had actually already decided to do that because I made music and I sort of played gigs and did that kind of stuff. So one, I could only really occupy one fanciful creative pipe dream at a time. And you can see it direct. As soon as I got to London, I slowly but surely started getting to write for money. Like my music just literally stopped happening completely. Because I was like, sod this. 2 completely financially unviable creative outlets cannot exist in my head at one time.
Oh my God, no. I can't believe I kind of glossed over the fact that you're in Dublin, because I think even if people don't know you from your Observer column or you're writing about fatherhood and trying to raise an Irish child in an English country, if they don't know you through the new book, if they don't know you through Usha or Crush, I think the entire world knows that you got skagged off your tits on ketamine and met the president.
Yes.
While working in Dublin.
President Mary McAleese, I should say. Michael D. Higgins has several times been implicated in my contagion, but that...
No, it was President McAleese.
President McAleese.
Your colleagues, we won't go through it because it's out there, and I think people deserve to read those tweets, you know, in their original form, because it's pardon the pun, but it's a trip.
Yeah. Well, the thing about that was, so I was still working at that terrible job I was already mentioning, and I was obviously still looking for an outlet. By this point, I had a column in the Irish Times, so I wasn't like completely unknown, but it was obviously still not the sort of thing you'd give up your job to do.
Yeah.
So I was just so bloody bored at work, just like terminally, but on that particular day, and I just saw this one post come up saying, what's the worst work-related fuck up you've ever had or something like that? And I replied just with this story in like, I think about 40 tweets connected, a 40 tweet thread of the time that I was serving drinks to Mary McAleese at a music venue in Dublin, which his name has been redacted.
And to protect the guilty.
Yeah. But it was that story of me. I'd taken ketamine that day because I thought I was off, and I was not off. And so I ended up having to do it. So I described that. So I really like that story. I always have, and I always will. And it's something which a few people, whenever we've been talking about this book, have kind of tiptoed around, maybe in the sense that it's like only being known for that one thing. Well, A, I'd be perfectly happy if that was the case. I think it very often is. And two, what I have been saying as well is there's a real positive aspect to being able to trace so many things that you got off the back of something, if that thing is really stupid. It frees you from a lot of petty vanities. I think I would be just as good, you know, at what I do, if I hadn't had that bolt of lightning that, like, I think something like 80 million people have read those tweets now.
That's amazing. So but like, it's a hell of a memento mori, like, you know, yeah. This idea, like the Romans used to have this guy would stand in the chariot behind successful generals as they were getting their parade, and he'd whisper in their ear, memento mori, remember you will die, so remember you're mortal. In your case, it's someone standing behind you whispering in your ear going, you're only here where you are because you got some poor idiot in Selfridges just to put arsenic on a jar of Nutella.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And there's that, like, that ring that was designed, isn't that sort of apocryphal tale of the Babylonian emperor who's looking for a ring that would make him happy when he was sad and sad when he was happy. And it was just a ring that said, this too shall pass. and I think it's good because the things that came from it, so I can directly attribute the Observer column to it. Probably the book deal for this book that I'm talking about kind of came from that thing because it got me on people's register. But also it wasn't, thankfully, hey, tell us stories about all these times you've taken drugs and served world leaders. Yeah. It was, hey, you seem to be able to tell a tale. What else have you got? So if it's an opportunity, that's great. If I was kind of being drafted all the time, and by the way, there were offers to like go and take drugs or to play sort of pranks and I could do, because doing that, I think I would have been like, okay, well, that's pigeonholing. But if it's just a calling card, then I'm glad that it worked in that way. I'm also glad that I mean, I reread it again recently because I had to do it up for I had to sort of present it for something, and I still really like it. I like the story because I was telling it for, like, you know, ever since it happened. So I'm glad that I got it all off because I was writing it literally in work as I went. There was nothing pre-planned. All of the flourishes that are so over the top and sort of self-serious and pompous, I think they land quite well. So yeah. More. Yeah, everyone should take drugs at work. That's the answer.
That's the moral of the story. I think it is nice. It is nice though that, like, whoever recognized the talent in this, they don't have you. They didn't see the next Hunter S. Thompson. They just saw like a talent for being what you said at the start. They were Shanachie, like a storyteller. Like, somebody's taken what could. Like, you could sum that up in one single tweet. Even before it went up to 280 characters, you could just say, "Thought I was off, ended up getting high, and had to serve drinks to the President of Ireland." Like, that's it. That's it in a nutshell. That's the story. But it's the descriptive nature of it. Just this, your use of language around it. I don't have an awful lot of experience at either meeting presidents or being off my face on ketamine on the wrong day. But I think you sort of summed up that experience so well that even I, an outsider, could understand what it was like.
Well, I think the really lovely part about it was that loads of people came out from the woodwork and said, oh God, I remember that night, people who I'd worked with and stuff. Oh, I remember that night. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And they weren't forthcoming about what part of it they witnessed or whatever. Cause I was on my own in the room, but there might've been other people who might've seen me, and I certainly have no memory of them, which is probably understandable if you read the thread. And then the other thing is, I mentioned, for example, that the ketamine was green and sort of, cause it was in a, a flourish of entrepreneurial sort of improvisation by the ketamine wholesaler dyed it green for St. Patrick's Day, which is just hilarious detail, which a lot of people thought was either made up or just stupid. But then two or three people, you know, very revealingly said, oh, I remember that stuff.
I got some of that patch.
I remember some of that stuff, allegedly. You know, so that was good. And also, I think the attention that it got was so huge and ridiculous that it was a very early primer for that feeling of being, you know, there's that brilliant tweet, which is every day on Twitter, there's a main character.
Yeah.
The goal is to not be it.
Not be that person.
So It was a very interesting experience to have that, you know, where your phone doesn't work because you're getting so much, you know, bits and bobs coming in. And also that it was something that it wasn't like me having a massive racist meltdown or, I don't know, just doing something really awful or embarrassing. It was at least in keeping with the stuff that I usually do. So
yeah. The goal is never to be the main character, but if you have to, if you absolutely insist on it, yeah. I think that was a relatively decent way to do it.
I got invited onto a stag do. I've looked for the tweet, the messages recently, but he must have deleted his account. A guy was going on a stag do to Edinburgh, and he was going to pay for me to come over and to give me ketamine, and to basically, I don't know, reenact the entire thing somehow. I don't know.
Was he bringing Mary McAleese?
Well, I don't know. She does.
Sounds like the best stag do ever. Basically.
Well, I was like, that's a very kind offer, but I'm actually fully booked for the rest of my life. I'm not going to go on a stag do. I was like, it's like when you go to like Carrick and Shannon or something, and there's like guys who are like selling gimp masks and everything else. It's like, is that what I am now? Am I the stag adjacent kind of provocateur? But no, other than that, everything that's come from that has been really good, and I can isolate it to being just one of those things. Because even aside from it not being a particularly weighty piece of journalism, it's also a complete fluke that I saw that question, that I replied to it, that I told the story that way. Because, you know, there's loads of days I would have just not seen it, would have been called into a meeting. Like at any point when I wrote all those tweets, I could have been, you know, spotted at my desk doing something I was not supposed to be doing, like called in to be sacked or something. So
imagine if you managed to turn up at work off your face on ketamine the day you were supposed to meet the president, and you didn't get sacked, but then you got sacked for trying to tell other people. Many years later, you got sacked from an entirely different job for trying to tell people about the time.
Yeah, I mean,
you got high at work.
So you won't sack me for doing drugs, but you will for honesty. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, it's Jibs here from Pints of Malt. So our podcast is basically a group of Irish Nigerian lads who tell their stories, growing up in Ireland as well as Nigeria. And we share our experiences with all of y'all. We also add a bit of comedy as well, you know, to get y'all laughing, get y'all through the week in these tough times that we are in. So y'all sit back and just, you know, enjoy the show.
As Jib said, we're the Pints of Malt podcast. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including the Headstuff Network.
So I mentioned as well, just before we get on to the matter at hand, the new book, I did mention as well just the Nutella incident, which I personally think is the greatest anti-capitalist satire of the 21st century. You managed to convince people in Selfridges when they were doing personalised Nutella jars that you had a traditional Irish name like Arsmuck or Bum Gravy, and they would publish basically euphemisms for shit on these jars of Nutella. And my favourite thing about the Daily Mail tried to do a hit piece on you about how sinister this thing was. And my favourite bit of it was... The Irishman, age 30, has spent £19 and admits he doesn't even like Nutella. Why? What? Why? How? Why? There's a twisted mind there, Seamus.
This is great. It's a nice little retrospective. So for me, it started because I saw that people were selling these personalised jars right beside where I worked. It was in Selfridges. Yeah. Around. Did I mention I was really bored of my job? I literally went in and I'd seen that a woman in Australia had complained because her daughter's name is Isis, and she tried to get Isis on it and they wouldn't let her because there's a blacklist of names that you can't use. So they wouldn't let you put in, you know, 9/11 was an inside job or swear words or Isis or whatever. So I thought, okay, right. So you can't get bollocks or you can't get whatever. What about back dirt? Because Because bacter is my favorite term for shit. And it's always rancid. Has been. It's just so disgusting. I need to do me back.
Rancid,
I need to
do me back door without losing it laughing. It's just
So. Yeah. So I mean, this is the thing about, you know, proper genius is it seems stupid on the outside, but to a true connoisseur who's very bored at his job, I thought at that moment, wouldn't it be funny if I, from my friends back home, particularly the ones in Dublin who introduced me to the joys of the word back dirt, if I could get a tub and a pen that said back dirt, I would be happy then. And I wouldn't have to look at my emails and cry at all of the work and all of the boringness. I could be happy then. I could be a happier me. So I went, I paid £7 to get it in a little presentation box as well, and just took a picture of it and sent it to some friends and got my little endorphin hit, put it on Twitter. I think I had about 3/4 of a follower back then. So it was just like nothing. And then by the time I did the third one, they'd picked up so much speed that the Daily Mail tried to interview me. Now, I refused an interview with the Daily Mail, but I did give one to the Trinity Mail Group, who then sold the interview to the Daily Mail. So it looks like I'm talking to them in that interview where they sew me up, but I wouldn't have given them the steam off my piss otherwise. But they reach out to the makers of Nutella, Ferrero Rocher.
Do you have it there? Will you read it? Because I can't. I lose it all the time.
It used to be the banner for my Twitter, but I had to change it for the stupid book.
I have it here. A spokesperson for Ferrero, manufacturers of Nutella, said, "The aim of the campaign is to give fans of Nutella the chance to personalize their favorite hazelnut spread in a fun and joyful way. It is disappointing that the campaign has been used in this way." Hey, that is like when someone that you look up to and you respect, an authority figure that you respect, like Mr. Ferrero or Mr. Rocher, they say, "I'm not even mad. I'm not even angry. I'm just disappointed."
Yeah, it is very, you've let yourself down here today. Yeah. You know, it's like a headmaster or possibly the vice principal, because the headmaster's not there, you know, lacking in any actual authority, but just overflowing with sort of studied indifferent disregard. So I took that as a badge of honor. I got 3 more in. I was reliably told there was a picture up saying, there was a picture up in their office, their little kiosk that they did the Nutella thing, which said not to accept to this guy, he's Irish and whatever. It's like, there's literal descriptions. I was followed around the shop once. And it's, yeah, be careful what you get famous for.
So the payoff where we are now is that you have a memoir, a retrospective, a personal history, and the title, it instantaneously grabs you. Like, this is something you're going to see on the shelf. And did you hear Mammy died? And I heard you tell the story, like, it originates from a 5-year-old you.
It does, yeah. It's a direct quote from me when I was 5. So my mum died 3 weeks before my 6th birthday. And I'm from a big family, so I'm one of 11. So my mum had left 11 kids behind, and my dad. And obviously, it's as you would imagine, extremely sad. So we're at a wake. There's 11 kids between the ages of 2 and 17. I'm at the younger end, so I'm 5. And there's 2 below me. I'm 9th and 9. And because obviously some of us were, you know, much, much younger and maybe a bit oblivious, we were kind of being, you know, handheld and kept on knees and just being looked after basically by this aunt and that uncle and family friends and whoever. But for whatever reason, for some stolen moment, I managed to get free, and I traipsed down the hall to where the door was ringing, you know, every few minutes with new people coming in to see the wake and everything. And I was obviously, you know, the permanence of death was somewhat lost on me. And so when they came in and I answered the door, I stuck my hand out and said, "Did you hear Mammy died?" as if it was the news, you know, of the day. It was like, "Oh, did you hear I saw a big bird?" Or, you know, whatever. And obviously the title refers just obviously to that, but also to the sort of the dissonance between the fact that I didn't know that it was permanent, and also that I didn't really know how to process things yet. So the whole book kind of goes through that whole arc of coming to terms with it, not coming to terms with it, how all of our family worked, and just the logistics of how a family of 11 works in a bungalow on the Derry Donegal border through the troubles and, you know, everything else. So I thought a title which could be funny and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
Was worth getting.
That's it. That's exactly what it is. Like, it's funny and sad at the same time. And like, something about Derry and just the sheer amount of talent, not just yourself, Lisa McGee, but I mean, one of my favorite books when I was younger, not that younger, but maybe when I was in college, I think I read it, maybe the end of secondary school, was Seamus Dean's book, Reading in the Dark.
Oh man, brilliant book, yeah.
It was a really brilliant, again, a memoir about a childhood in Derry, obviously completely and totally different, but there's, I find it really, really tricky to, like, when you pick up a book, sometimes you pick up a book and it's about the author as a child, or like some kind of a surrogate for the author as a child. And sometimes it's risky because sometimes it's a bit shit. Because like sometimes you're reading it and you're going like, there's no fucking way you knew this as a child.
Yeah. Like, and also, I mean, how many interesting things really happen to kids?
I think if you got a family of 11 in Derry during the Troubles, there's a fair amount of interesting shit that could have happened.
I mean, thanks God.
I think you're on the safe side of that.
Yeah. It's one of the better things about the Troubles. Yeah.
I did say interesting. I didn't say funny in that particular regard. So look, obviously it's, there are so many pointless and banal questions I could ask you around, like, you know, sure, what was it like to grow up without a mother or something like that, you know, but I'm sure you'll get a lot of those as you do these sort of interview circuits. But I suppose I want to ask you about, because we tend to deal in like the cultural nuances and subtleties and idiosyncrasies of being Irish and Irish culture and all that. And you've been in England for a while now. Do we do grief differently?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really, really interesting thing and something I've talked to a lot of people about. I think a lot of people in England are aware of the idea of the Irish wake, but probably from slightly hackneyed representations in movies and, you know, not even just Irish things, but, you know, whenever they're exported to sort of Boston Catholics and that kind of thing. Mm. But it's definitely true. I mean, if you go to an English funeral, they can be rather more reserved. There's also just the sort of presence of the flesh. There's the idea that the person is there, you know, if you have an open casket anyway, which we did, that you see the person there, like all waxy and strange, you know, there's a closeness to the body in that sense, in the ritual sense. And also the fact that it's very much a communal get together. And in wakes, it wouldn't be unusual to have singing. It wouldn't be unusual for people to be staying to the wee small hours and drinking and chatting and laughing, you know, laughter, even in a place as tragic as, you know, my mum was 43 when she died. She left 11 kids behind her. She was a saintly woman that everybody loved. She'd only lived in Derry for 6 years and she had over 1,000 people at her funeral. For years and years afterwards, I'd be stopped on the street by someone who'd recognize my resemblance to her or to my other brothers and sisters that they did know, and they'd stop and they'd give me a soliloquy about, you know, how amazing she was. So that's the saddest, most mirth-free example of a funeral and a wake you could imagine. But there was still laughter. There were still people telling funny stories. There were still people singing songs. And that is, I think that's, it's not just sort of a break from grief and a sort of a stop valve against grief. It's a part of the healing process, you know? And if you're trying to, that old idea that if there's no laughter to wake, it's barely a tribute, you know, it should be that thing. And that's easier to say, obviously, if someone's lived a long and happy life and they died with the people around them and everything. But even in those times when it's so dark and there's no way out of it, then I think that's something that we do quite well. There's a lot of things I think that Irish culture and society doesn't do well.
Yeah.
To do with psychology and, I think, you know, mental health and opening up. And I think particularly men, young men and older men. But that might be one thing that we do quite well. And also just keeping you busy. You know, if you're hosting a wake, you can grieve, but you have to make 600 cups of tea and fashion several pyramids of sandwiches. You know,
In my wife's part of the country, it's always a huge pot of chicken curry.
Oh, really?
That's part of it for the wake. And it's always 2 days where the body's reposing in the family home.
Yeah.
And it's always a massive pot of chicken curry, as well as your mountain of sandwiches and your millions and millions of cups of tea. And it does, it keeps you going. One thing that somebody said to me, and I think it resonates, I've lost relatives who've lived in Britain, and it's it's weeks until you have a funeral.
Yeah.
I think the fact that we do it while everything is so raw and while the emotions are still being incredibly, you know, everything's all fucked up because you've no idea how you should be feeling because it literally just happened the other day. I think that's why we have this more cathartic process, and that the wake is that mixture of joy and celebration as well as grief and desolation.
Yeah, well, I was speaking to someone just there 2 days ago who's British Nigerian, and he was saying that the way the Nigerians, and he said also Ghanaians, but I'm sure it's true of lots of, you know, African countries, the way they wake the dead is very similar. You know, it is much more of a communal thing. It's constant eating. It's into the wee small hours. You know, there's more of a, it's a very communal thing. Loads of adults and children all together. There will be laughter. There will be music. So I think maybe we only think it's strange compared to, you know, the superculture of Britain. You know, I mean, I don't, for example, know, I think some of the Scandinavians and the Germans seem to be similarly quite reserved at these things. But the Mediterraneans and a lot of the Arab countries and definitely the West African countries, people from those places always point this out as a big thing, you know, and that kind of drills down even to beyond wakes and funerals, things about eating, being forced to eat when you arrive in someone's house, you know? And it's, as someone from southern Italy meets an Irish person, they will immediately talk, they can talk about that aspect of their lives, is that having to go to someone's house and eat until you want to die.
Do they have the polite refusal as well? Do they have to do that? Or?
Well, there's that amazing three time thing where you can say no twice, and then there's a brilliant phrase in Irish which I don't remember, which is a two time asker. Do you know that one?
No.
It's someone who says, who offers it to you twice, knowing that you can only ask, you have to ask a third time before it's accepted.
I'll have to look that one up, but that is perfect. That's spot on.
Like. That's a two-time asker. They're so abstemious. They're so tight that they'll ask you twice if you want a sandwich so that they don't get the third ask
which will be the actual yes. Yeah. I'll go on.
Oh, you're fine then. But that's the other thing. I was just talking to someone else today in one of these things about how in Britain, Father Ted, Mrs. Doyle, and the constantly asking about tea, or the pyramid of sandwiches, how that was seen as part of the absurd properties of Father Ted, which it has loads of. You know, there's really silly, outsized craziness that is amazing about Father Ted. But Irish people then have to always correct them, say, no, that's like more observational. That's like a kitchen sink. Yeah. That's not even like the height of those pyramids is not really, it's like 5% more than I would have seen my entire life.
Yeah. It's only slightly exaggerated for emphasis. Mrs. Doyle is only asking, she's only insisting on the cup of tea slightly more than your granny or your auntie would.
Yeah, because they think that she's just a complete insane person who happens to live in their house. Is it? No, she's just a 10% more insistent version of someone that is so familiar to all Irish people. And you kind of fall down that rabbit hole because at one point you kind of want to, you know, say, well, you know, we're not all like this. We're not all pig holding slatterns who, you know, get into leaping contests with the fairy folk. But on the other hand, it's a small country and some stereotypes are a real time saver. And I think some of the rubrics about Irish culture that are very universal to us are not really known outside. So I quite like either dispelling the myths or perhaps propagating some myths.
I'm just sort of saying, listen, cultural stereotypes are bad except for that one, and that one, which are actually incredibly accurate.
I do. I have a column for The Observer, which I've been writing for 3 years, and I can never, ever predict what will hit or what will land, no matter what I talk about. And the two times that it's really blown up to a degree that was almost uncomfortable was when I said that lasagna with coleslaw is not a bad combination, but it's a strange combination. And it was
like declaring fucking war.
It was like I took out a hit on Michael D. Higgins and Bosco on the same day. And not only that, but all the English people in my mentions were like, what are you even talking about? Italians. You should have heard the Italians in my mentions. So they were like, please report anybody you've seen doing this to me and I will personally have them professionally killed. The other one was heating plates. Now, my family were not a family where we heated plates because we grew up without a mother. Oh, but we didn't have heated plates.
That's a great throwaway. I can't have any interjection or comment there. That's
I know. That's great. That's why I called the book that, so I wouldn't get any bad reviews unless, you know, people were just like laughing at my half orphanage. So heating plates. I said, oh, I don't understand why people heat plates. I don't get it. Like, and it was literally like I'd spat in Enya's face. It was just a tirade against me. I've kind of realized slowly but surely that lots of things that I think are universal tend to be just because I'm from Ireland or just because I'm from Derry. And when I was writing the book, I found that an awful lot of the things that I was going through, the specifics of just even my living with 10 other people for so much of my life, I was like, oh, right, I haven't actually worked out that's not usual. Like, most people don't have to bring their fingers into it when they count their siblings, or don't have to mention them all in age order every time they do. Because I can only really mention their names in age order. So like being able to tangle those things, you know, I think living here and having to speak about these experiences and just wider experiences of Ireland, Northern Ireland particularly, living on the border, which is never was mentioned once in my life until about 5 years ago. I can't remember why. living that experience has been something where I've had to explain to people things which I never thought I'd ever have to explain, like the idea that a 300-mile border, which is mostly hedges and fields and has, you know, about 12 major crossings, but apart from that is just open farmland and rickety bridges and my dad's fence, which he has to keep a horse out of his roses. You know, that's not militarizable. That's not something, yeah. it's not something that you can put a machine gun turret on top of, you know. So yeah. I think it's very good training if you go to another place to ferret out those differences and to find what it is about those things that you learn about yourself and about the place you're in that are interesting and things that you can maybe turn into sort of an insight that you can use or that you can hit upon to kind of, you know, hammer home some of those differences. Because at the end of the day, people who've lived it like to see that stuff talked about, and people who haven't are often bewildered and surprised and amazed.
And it's in that sort of bewilderment and surprise and amazement that you can really get to grips with new experiences and sort of understand other cultures. So it's something we do when we go to other places and we learn about them. But I think it really does come through. In particular, I've loved your Observer column because I think you had your kid sort of around about the same time I had mine, and I really enjoyed watching your struggles and failures and successes, mostly failures because they're funnier. You probably write about more of those, but I really enjoyed that, and it's really resonated with me. And I think there's going to be something in the book that's going to resonate with everyone, even if you haven't lost your mammy tragically at a young age, or even if you don't have 10 siblings or a father who's struggling to deal with all of it. But look, the book is out now. Did You Hear Mammy Died? Is published by Fleet, and it's available. I've always wanted to say this. It's available at all good bookstores, yeah?
Yay, it is indeed. And some of the bad ones.
So Derek normally gets to say all the cool catchphrases, which is why, and you won't hear this on the final pod, but I completely fucked up the intro. Yeah. And we had to retake it because Derek normally does all of that, but unfortunately he's away. But I had the pleasure of speaking to you, Seamus O'Reilly. We always ask all of our guests, do you have a favourite Irish word?
I do. It's Amadon.
Ah, nice one.
Yeah.
It's one of the classics.
It is. And it's probably one you've probably been given before. I just love how easily it trips off the tongue. And it sounds like someone being hit with a club on both sides of the face. You know, it has that little chip. It's great.
It's got that sort of those bass notes, that timbre to it. I like it. I like Amadon because it's very soft. Like it literally translates as idiot. But it's kind of in the same way that Egypt is softer than idiot. I think Amadon is even softer again. Like
it's almost affectionate. Yeah.
Or it is, yeah. 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 Sure, look at the big owl Amadon over there with his book and his column and his Seamus, thanks a million. It's been a pleasure.
It's been absolutely delightful. Thanks for having me.
Mother Folklore Last Orders will, for the time being, come out every Friday until we finish up this wonderful podcast adventure. Thanks, as always, to all of you for tuning in. Thanks to Kirsten Shield for the art and to Brian for producing. Derek will be back and normal service will resume in next week's Mother Folklore Last Orders. Slán.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
He asks a question and you hear a very distant...